And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. And I always remind you, you can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm, and check us on the web at taylor-report.com for previous programs and some written materials. For example, Chris Black and others have put together an indictment of NATO war crimes in Libya, and we've posted that, and I urge you to have a look at it and sign on to it as a common plea that the international community, as it's called, will do the right thing. Today on the program, we're going to be talking to Mahdi Dariush Nazim Roya. You will remember we spoke to him on this program, and he's quite well known in Canada and elsewhere in the world for his reporting on the struggle, the recent war in Libya. And he was in Tripoli and also got around there, and one of the best and most reliable journalists functioning there. So we're going to ask him about the new developments. He has an article in Global Research .ca. The title of his article is Syria, the Orwellian Responsibility to Protect, R2P, Used to Justify Regime Change and All-Out War. And that's in the, you'll find that it was published in Global Research and is featured there on that site. And that's, of course, conducted by Michael Chosadowski, another outstanding figure if anybody wants to know what's actually going on in the world. And later in the program, at the halfway point, we're going to be talking to Imab Mugara. And Imab has an excellent website, RwandaHumanRights.org. A journalist a Rwandan journalist who was living in Uganda has been assassinated, and his name is Charles Ingabire, which just happens to be the name of the the former presidential candidate, Ms. Ingabire Victoire. They're not related, but it will help people remember and know what is going on there, because Charles Ingabire was an RPF insider. He was a journalist, functioned in Rwanda in support of the Kagame regime, and had his differences with them, and as will happen in the world of journalism in Rwanda, he had to run for his life. He was living in Uganda but continuing to function as a journalist, and 2 days ago was assassinated. It was mentioned in a one-paragraph story I saw in a Toronto Star. And, of course, the most important thing they thought they should say is that it had been the Rwandan government denied they had anything to do with it, as in the case of everybody else who used to be there who's been shot. You'd think they might be able to help a little bit. So I think we are joined now by Mahdi Nazim Roya. Are you there, sir?
Yes, I am. How are you?
Good. It's sure good to talk to you. You did an outstanding job. We all followed your writing at globalresearch.ca when you were in Tripoli, Libya, and the bombs were falling, as they say. And as a matter of fact, we all worried for you, and we're happy when you were able to extricate yourself from that situation. But you have a nose for trouble, so you're now writing about Syria, and the article is titled Syria, the Orwellian Responsibility to Protect, R2P, Used to Justify Regime Change and All-Out War. Are you thinking of going to Syria, by the way? You told us you might.
Yes, I am thinking of going to both Lebanon and its neighboring sister Republic of Syria. So both Lebanon and Syria, and I was invited to go by the Maronite Church and the Catholic Churches of the East, the Autonomous Catholic Churches of the East. Last month, I had to decline because of my affairs here at the university. But I may be there this month or next month. I've been asked several times to go to Syria, and it's something that's continuously being brought up.
Mm-hmm. You know, that raises... I think I better grab the opportunity to ask you about the kind of sectarian violence and the NATO-inspired bad deeds being performed there. And we're in a culture which talks about Islam a lot. There is a question of Christian minorities in that region, and the governments, as far as I know, of the previous government, that would be the Gaddafi government of Libya, and the present government of Syria under Assad, have been, because they were secular regimes, these were areas where Christians were living at peace with their neighbors. But that isn't the case anymore, is it?
Well, the Christians right now in Syria are being targeted, and if you want to see the mentality of the Christians in the Levant, you just have to see the statements that their patriarchs and their cardinals are making, both in the Eastern Catholic churches and in the Eastern Orthodox churches. They're all coming against, they're all making public and very strong statements about what's happening. So that includes for example, several archbishops, even archbishops that are not Syrian, like the Archbishop of Jerusalem, the Eastern Syriac Orthodox Archbishop of Jerusalem, has come out against the violence in Syria, and he's asking for people to be patient with the reforms. And they do not want violence, and they're all afraid of a Muslim Brotherhood or Salafist takeover of Syria, which is what would happen if there is regime change. Mm-hmm. And they're very afraid that their communities, which are amongst the oldest Christian communities in the world, will be targeted even further than they are now. In fact, the so-called Syrian opposition, which is being supported by the government of Canada, the United States, and NATO, it's the Syrian National Council, has made some statements in the last few days trying to reassure the Christian community in Syria and even in Lebanon. But they're not believing it, and they don't consider the Syrian National Council as the legitimate opposition of the Syrian people either.
Mm-hmm. This is a remarkable situation. I believe that there is also a very large Christian population that came as refugees from Iraq. Is that the case in Syria? Do you know?
Yes. There's a lot of Iraqi refugees in Syria, period. There's a lot of Palestinian refugees and a lot of Iraqi refugees in Syria. A lot of the majority of the refugees in Syria happen to be Muslims, but there is a significant amount of Christians who have gone to the Syrian Arab Republic as refugees. And for those of the audience who don't know, those of the listeners at home who are not aware, the Iraqi Christian community, which is also amongst the most ancient Christian communities in the world, is virtually extinct. Under the watchful eyes of the occupational forces of the United States, Britain, and their coalition, which occupied Iraq, they've been wiped out of Iraq, basically. Their churches attacked, their leaders attacked. The United States, actually, the United States Armed Forces have actually taken away some of their properties. Like, one of the oldest cathedrals in Iraq was turned into a U.S. Military barracks.
Incredible.
Yeah, it was very upsetting to the community, and they've virtually been wiped out in Iraq. And this is the fear right now in Syria, which Christians in Syria form about 15%, 10 to 15%, maybe even more of the population. They're a large minority, a significant minority. And in Lebanon, the Christians, depends on who you ask, are about 50 to 30 to 25% of the population. They run anywhere from 25 to 50% of the population. So these countries, the Christian communities are very worried. They're very worried of a Muslim Brotherhood takeover, which would not ensure an open, pluralistic, secular society. The Muslim Brotherhood is not there for, does not want to establish a democratic system. These are not democracy. Protesters who want democracy. They want a caliphate, but want some sort of theocratic rule.
Yeah, that's, Your title, it couldn't be more appropriate. I mean, it is, in order to talk about these things, it's almost a kind of mind-bending exercise. I mean, the Orwellian quality, because after all, we are in a culture here where it's pretty much mainstream to be Islamophobia, but our government, basically both in the United States and, well, certainly Britain and France and Canada, somewhat sponsor Islamophobia, but meanwhile they're aligned with a form of Islam which is highly bigoted, as I understand it. I mean, for example, the Saudis don't allow Christian activity at all.
Oh, definitely. In fact, under the Saudi Arabians, this is actually a historic irony too. Under Saudi Arabia, all Christians and Jews had to leave Mecca under the Saudi regime. They had to leave.
And this is our best friend.
Yeah, well, they had to leave. They were forced out, which is very ironic, because during the time of the Prophet Muhammad, Christians and Jews lived with him in Mecca. So I don't know what the Saudis are, what type of Islam the Saudis represent, but, you know, not allowing women to drive cars, this extreme form of Islam is really a power mechanism.
I understand that driving cars can lead to sex, as the idea.
They will not. Well, they have a lot of excuses, but in Saudi Arabia is not a country of equality at all, and we're aligned with very extreme, like very dangerous ideological movements. You know, like in Libya, the same thing. We essentially supported Al-Qaeda-like groups. So our government, while we talk about being against these deviant movements, you know, that you hide behind faith, we're actually supporting them in other countries and letting them usurp power. So in Syria, the United States has no problems with allowing the Muslim Brotherhood and or any extremist groups take over at all. As long as they will be in tune with U.S. foreign policy, you know, there's a deal with them. Essentially, they're going to become aligned with U.S. foreign policy, so they'll be opposed to Lebanon, specifically the resistance there. They'll be opposed to the Palestinians. They'll be against Iran, which is the major power against the United States in that region, and they will. They will follow Washington's lead, just like Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Mahdi Nazimroya, and you can read his articles primarily in globalresearch.ca, a very brave reporter who's been was right there in Libya when the bad things were going down. And Mahdi, this matter of who these gentlemen are, you saw a curious political formation, I guess it's called the National Transition Council in Libya, who still, I guess, somewhat obscure as to who they, what they, their point of view is. But we're seeing in Syria a kind of mirror, aren't we? I mean, as a matter of fact, aren't they the first ones to now recognize as a legitimate state or representative of the Syrian people, another sort of a National Transition Council for Syria?
Yes, this is what has occurred in Syria. They are copying the Libya model. You can call it Libya 2.0. Everything they've done to the Libyan Arab Jamhuriya is being repeated against the Syrian Arab Republic. That includes using the Human Rights Council. That includes creating this proxy group and then trying to strip away the sovereignty of Syria and hand it to them. You know, this is an unpopular group. Incomparable, actually, to the Libyan Transitional Council, because it has nobody on the ground at all, aside for some members of the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood controls it. Now, I want to point something out. In Syria, there's three transitional councils. There was one that was formed in Ankara, one that was formed in Istanbul, and that's the Syrian National Council, and there was one that was formed internally in Syria. The one internally is the one that has opposition members on the ground in Syria. It's called the Syrian Coordination Committee, National Coordination Committee. Mm-hmm. And don't want regime change. They want reform. They don't want violence use. They don't want foreign intervention. While the one that's outside, specifically the Syrian National Council, which was formed in Turkey with the help of the Gulf Cooperation Council, that's Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, and Kuwait, and Oman as well. These countries, along with Turkey and France as well, helped form that one, the Syrian National Council. Mm-hmm. And that is the one that is illegitimate. It does not have popular support on the ground. As far as the other representative, most of the representatives is concerned, it's actually the Muslim Brotherhood that runs the show. Now, there is a portion of the population that supports the Muslim Brotherhood, but it is not a significant or representative portion of the population. It is not representative of the Syrian population at all. So you have three opposition movements. One of them is internal, two are external, and it's the two external ones that are being they're being handpicked as the new leaders of Syria, but essentially by NATO. In fact, their lead is given to the Syrian National Council, and even when the internal opposition of Syria wants to meet with the Arab League, that's the Syrian National Coordination Committee. They went to meet the Arab League in Cairo. They were beaten up by the supporters of the Syrian National Council. The Syrian National Council on its website, or proxy website, supporters, has pictures of missile sites and military facilities in Syria where it's openly asking NATO for bombing. Mm-hmm. It's asking NATO to bomb Syria. They're doing everything. They're asking for foreign intervention. They're asking for bombing. They're singing the tune for Washington's foreign policy. They've said if we come into power, we will stop supporting Arab resistance groups against Israel, and we will cut our ties, specifically strategic and militarily, with Iran, which is Syria's closest ally. Mm-hmm. Iran has been part of an alliance with Syria, part of the Damascus-Tehran axis, for over 30 years. It's the oldest alliance in the Middle East, and the strongest alliance in the Middle East, and they've pledged to leave that alliance if they come into power, which is really one of the reasons why Syria is being targeted. It has a lot to do with Iran and the resistance in the Middle East towards Washington and its agenda in that region.
Yeah. This is Mahdi Nazim Roya, globalresearch.ca. And Nazim, if you could be patient with us a moment, we want to take a break and then get back. Call you right back. We want to improve the line a little bit if we can. We'll just take a brief break. Is it okay?
Okay, that's very fine.
Okay. Yeah.
You only have 5 days left to be entered into the CIUT 89.5 FM Grand Prize Draw.
Get your pledges paid today to be entered into two draws.
You could win a two-night stay for two people at the Briars Resort on Lake Simcoe.
Or an Urbanite 20-something bicycle from Urbane Cyclist.
To pay your pledge or find more information, go to www.ciut.fm.
CIUT 89.5 FM, celebrating 25 years from the roots up.
And this is CIUT, the Taylor Report, and we're going to be rejoining Mahdi Nazim Roya very briefly. And tell you again, his article is in globalresearch.ca, and he's discussing the kind of the Orwellian situation, and it certainly is. And thank heavens we have global research and people like Nazim, by the way, that are keeping us on top of this and clarifying. This, I mean, for example, that issue of repression of Christians, it's just maddening that so much is made here of the attitude of picking on Muslims, but then the Canadian government, U.S. government, embrace the ugliest forms of that in the Middle East. So, again, we're lucky to have Mahdi Nazim Roya. Hi, we're back. Hey. Are you there?
I'm here. Yes, sir.
You were clarifying this matter, and probably we'll read just to a little bit of this. You're pointing out that Syria is really at the crossroads. I mean, they're a friend of the Islamic Republic of Iran. They, of course, have a big role in Lebanon, and there is a political movement there that everyone has heard of, Hezbollah. Everybody's, and the Palestinians, everybody's affected by what's going on here.
Don't forget Iraq. Iraq as well.
You know, I did forget, and then I think you need to remind us of why that's important. I mean, I know that we that's a that the former government of Iraq used to have the label Ba'athist, and of course the Assad government is historically Ba'athist. And of course, we have the phenomenon of secular governments, which seem to be just disappearing in the Middle East. Everybody's celebrating the disappearance of secular governments and non-monarchies.
Okay, well, Syria is very important, as you said, because geopolitically, geostrategically, it sits at a very important crossroad. It's facing the Eastern Mediterranean. It's attached to all these, if you will, hot spots or geographic places of interest for the United States. It borders Israel. It borders Lebanon. It borders Turkey to the north, Iraq to the east. Three resistance movements are tied to the Syrians, to Damascus. The resistance movements in Iraq, which were against the Anglo-American occupation, after 2003. The resistance movements in Lebanon, as you rightly said, Hezbollah, the Shiite Muslim political party in Lebanon. The Shiites are the largest plurality in Lebanon, but those aren't the only people that Syria is tied to or allied to in Lebanon. The biggest Christian party in Lebanon, which is called the Free Patriotic Movement, it's led by a former military commander of the Lebanese Armed Forces, General Michel Aoun. They are also aligned to Syria. Several Druze groups, this is another faith, are also aligned to Lebanon, to Syria, I should say. And you have several of the Christian groups, as well as the Amal movement, which is also a Shiite political party led by Nabi Berri, who's the Speaker of the Lebanese Parliament. These are Syria's allies in Lebanon. So it's not just the Hezbollah, it's several parties.
And those are not insubstantial people. Any of those that you describe are powerful elements.
Yes, yes, of course. Syria and Lebanon are intertwined. Like, to get to Damascus, Beirut is the stepping stone to Damascus. They're intertwined. You can't. When Lebanon is attacked, essentially Syria is attacked. Whatever affects Syria will affect Lebanon. You know, the relationship of Syria and Lebanon is even closer than Canada and the United States. If there's if there's destabilization in Syria, it will go over into Lebanon. This is why a lot of Lebanese are worried. In Lebanon, this is a huge issue, and this is one of the reasons that Lebanon was the only one of the three countries in the Arab League were voted against the sanctions against Syria, including Syria itself. Those were Yemen, Lebanon, Syria were the three, and Iraq abstained. It abstained. Mm-hmm. You know, so in fact, the Arab League has voted for sanctions, and the Arab League is a hollow, worthless body, because it's been hijacked by the Gulf Cooperation Council, which Saudi Arabia and Qatar are in, and they've hijacked it, and they've actually broken the Arab League charter. When Syria was suspended by the Arab League, this hollow body that's being used as a shield, you know, to try to give this isolation of Syria some sort of image of Arab legitimacy when it has no legitimacy, because those are all dictatorships, essentially. They're not representative of the Arab world or the Arab people. But
And the more they are dictatorships, the more they are liked and embraced by the West.
Yeah, it's very ironic. These wars for freedom, like in Libya, you see dictatorships so-called democracies aligned together, you know, and they want to do the same thing in Syria. Is that how you spread democracies? Can dictatorships spread democracies? Are dictatorships partners?
Yeah.
How come Saudi Arabia and Bahrain and Kuwait are exceptional, but Syria and Libya are not? This is obviously has to do with foreign policy.
Mm-hmm.
International law is being wielded as a club.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Mahdi Nazimroya as an excellent piece on Syria in globalresearch.ca. And this issue, of course, we left out a name of a state that is very hard to understand on this program. 2 weeks ago, I was speaking to Rick Razov on this program, and I said I couldn't think of another term for it. Turkey, I said, seems to be going through a personality disorder. a year ago, they were going to stand up to Israel, and they were taking over the leadership, and they were going to do a bunch of things. Now they're talking like they want to go to war with Syria, and as a matter of fact, if anybody is, I assume they're the most likely. What do you make of their behavior? How do you explain what they're doing?
Well, I for one, have never. I've been always skeptical of the Turks. So even when they spoke about the flotilla, they were secretly talking with the Israelis. There should be no mistake about it. The Turks and the Israelis are allies in every sense, from militarily to strategically, and they have deep intelligence, coordination, and cooperation. You know, a lot of the things coming out of Ankara by the Turkish government, and specifically its outspoken prime minister, has been a PR campaign. Years ago, the George W. Bush administration in the White House and Tony Blair in London decided that they would form a coalition of the moderate, as they called it, in the Middle East, and Turkey would be a key member. And in order for Turkey to be a leader and a key member, alongside with Israel, Saudi Arabia, and those Gulf autocracies, Turkey would need to improve its image in the Middle East, North Africa, and the Arab world. What did it need to do? It needed to grandstand. And that's when you had the Turkish prime minister stand up to the Israeli president during publicly, you know, about what
walked
was happening.
Out on Paris.
Yeah, that was staged. That was staged. I can tell you that right now. When he said that Israel should be kicked out of the United Nations, I can tell you how insincere it was and pointed out. Because if he was very sincere, he would have kicked the Israeli ambassador out of Ankara. He could have cut relations with them. Instead of making demands he knew would never go through, kick him out of the UN, you know, telling the UN, which he's not responsible for, stop recognizing them, kick him out. But he wouldn't do the same thing at home. So the Turks also, at the same time that they started these operations, started signing economic MOUs, memorandums of understanding and agreements in the Arab world. They started talking to the Syrians. They had rapprochement with the Syrians. That was part of their zero problems policy with all their neighbors.
Right.
They started talking to the Iranians, which they need, actually, economically, and they try to form an alliance with the Syrians. And for a long time, they've been trying to de-link Syria from Iran, they've tried to create a triple entente with them, Syria and Qatar. Everything that they talked to Syria was to divide it from Iran. But I don't want to detract too much. At the same time that they did this, they launched their own Arabic network, okay, an Arab channel to win hearts and minds in the Arab world. Now, let me tell you, media nowadays are used for warfare. Like, for example, for warfare and winning hearts and minds. When Iraq was invaded in 2003 by the United States and the United Kingdom, the Iranians immediately launched their Arabic network, which is one of the biggest Arab news networks in the Middle East and very popular, if not the most popular channel in Iraq, post-2003 Iraq. So media is used for hearts and minds. And the Russians also launched their Arabic. But the Turks did this to win hearts and minds. You know, they started signing free trade agreements with all these countries. When Libya was being attacked, they pretended to be on Gaddafi's side or neutral, but they were working all that time with the Transitional Council, NATO. In fact, if they wanted to stop the war, they could have in Brussels. All it took was one member to say, no, we're against the war. And if Germany and Turkey were really against it, they could have blocked the war. You know, but Turkey was part of the naval campaign. It was the airport authority in Benghazi, which NATO selected. So it gave citizenship to members of the Libyan Transitional Council.
Yeah.
And Turkish intelligence, I can tell you, I know for a fact from the documents I've seen, was heavily involved in Libya and connected informants and operatives on the ground, Libyan ones, to the other ones in other NATO countries. Turkey's been playing this very dirty game, and it wants to create this so-called humanitarian buffer zone in northern Syria. This buffer zone is basically a land no-fly zone, and they're going to use it to station the so-called Syrian Free Army there.
Yeah. And by the way, the language, they say that Syria to them is a domestic matter, right? A Turkish matter.
Yeah, well, for them it's a domestic... They're saying that...
I mean, that's like Britain announcing that they're responsible for what goes on here.
Exactly.
Because we're part of the Commonwealth.
Exactly. They're saying that this is for Syria. They're saying this is not a Syrian domestic matter. It's important to Turkish domestic politics, and it's for the region. Yes, everything they've been saying
in language,
is for intervention.
In language, among self-respecting states, that is like almost an act of war to make such a claim, because you have no right to do it, right?
Well, they have essentially been helping again in a war to topple the regime in Syria. Mm-hmm. You know, Syrian officials have become very frank now. They said what the Turkish demands are. When the Turks initially asked them for reform, they didn't mean reform to a democracy. They meant change your foreign policy and give in to Washington. For the last few years, every delegation from France and Europe and Washington that's been going there has been trying to force Damascus to change its foreign policy, to follow, to toe the line that Washington says. And the Turks, that's all they said to them. They said, toe the line, you know, which includes giving up Hezbollah, giving up Hamas and the Palestinian resistance groups. There's 12 Palestinian resistance groups. They're called the rejectionists because they reject the so-called spineless and unfair peace. It's not really peace. It's Orwellian too with Israel, because it's basically saying become give in. You know, you know. I'm not talking about fighting, but the so-called peace talks with Israel are a joke. It's actually a colonial device. You know.
Yes. So are they still calling it the process?
Yeah, the peace process.
It's the eternal process.
It's a never-ending drama. It's a joke that buys time while the West Bank is slowly colonized and turned into a Bantustan, you know?
Yeah.
But this is what the Syrians, the Turks have been doing, and they've been letting weapons go in from Turkey into Syria, just like the Jordanians have, and just like how the Hariri movement in Lebanon has, which is tied to Saudi Arabia, the Gulf Cooperation Council. They've been sending weapons in from all the borders into Syria. In fact, when all the problems started in Syria, they were around the border region, because the weapons were being smuggled in there, money was being sent in there, and you have snipers targeting people, and they don't know who these snipers are. That's the biggest fear right now in Syria, what people on the ground say, is the snipers firing them. Like, I am not here to apologize for the Assad government. It is not a democracy. It is not an ideal government by my standards, and I think by the standards of many Canadians. But the fact is that this government's being framed, that despite its problems, for example, I could be a criminal, and I'm not saying they're criminals, but let's say for argument's sake that I'm a criminal, but I live in a very nice house, and my neighbor wants to steal everything I have in my house. They're going to use the fact that I'm a criminal to push their interests and come steal from me. This is what's happening in Syria. It's not an ideal government, but let me tell you right now, it might not be a perfect government, but a war that will kill people just like they have in Libya, that'll take the country backwards, that'll destabilize the region,
who's going to benefit from that?
Who is going to benefit from that? They're hiding behind democracy and human rights.
This is Mahdi Nazemroya, and you've actually come to the subject that I think we really have to discuss, which is Russia-China, but particularly Russia, signed on in Libya to the no-fly and the idea of responsibility to protect to a degree. Now, they said that they were lied to, and they say they won't do that again. And we hear that there is some Russian warships actually coming into the area. We know already U.S. warships. Are they going to be able to maintain this? Are they going to back away? How dangerous is the situation?
Okay, well, I let me start off by addressing Libya. I think the Russians and the Chinese, number one, Muammar Gaddafi's government in Libya was capitalizing on all its relationships. You know, it made deals with all sides, okay? This isolated it to an extent. When it had rapprochement with Washington and London and the major EU powers, for example, it gave some intelligence information about Palestinian resistance groups to them, which isolated it. It was already broken off from Lebanon and Iran. One of the reasons was a Shiite cleric named Imam Musa Sadr, Sheikh Musa Sadr, had disappeared in Libya.
By the way, that case, there's a whole subject, but I guess I should ask you quickly, is there any progress made on locating him?
Well, there's talk now. I know the Iranian foreign minister was there to discuss his whereabouts, and this is really important to the Iranians and the Iraqis and the Lebanese. Mm-hmm. But I don't know about that, but I don't want to spend too much time
right.
on Libya.
Yeah, I wanted to say that there's a subject you flagged. That is, you're quite right. And here it's not reported at all because, of course, it's the wrong guy who might have been harmed, so nobody cares. But in that part of the world, they care a lot. But I'm sorry, I did interrupt you. You were making the point about whether the Russians are going to behave differently
yes.
with Syria.
Well, the Russians and the Chinese, from my understanding and what I strongly believe is that they knew that these events were coming. And in fact, if you want to quote General Wesley Clark, Supreme Commander of NATO and a four-star U.S. General, what did he say? And he was the one who led the operations against Yugoslavia, the air war. But what did he say? He said that the United States planned to attack after Afghanistan several countries. And they were Iraq, Lebanon, Syria, Somalia, Sudan, Libya, and finally Iran. So they already had this plan. Everything else was a pretext, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The Russians and the Chinese were aware of this. Moscow and Beijing are aware of this. And they're aware that they're targets. That's what that Mishas shield is for. That's what the bases around China are for. That's what the naval operations are for. In fact, the United States has made it very clear. You know, they're basing soldiers now in Australia. They've made it very clear. We're not going to let China be the main power in the Asia-Pacific. And that missile shield in Eastern Europe and Turkey and the Caucasus, same thing. So they're aware that they're going to be targeted. What they did is they gave up Libya so they could protect Syria. They're uh-huh. protecting Syria. They sacrificed basically Libya to protect Syria. And Syria is a real ally to them, an authentic ally. Syria and Russia are allies. Syria and Iran are allies. And the Chinese look out for Syria. Russia has bases in Syria. They have military relations. The Russian Navy is going to Syria because they have ports. You know, they have ports. They've had these ports since the Soviet era, before the USSR broke up, and Russia maintained them. They're very important to keeping the Russian lifeline in the Mediterranean Sea. So that they have missile silos there, they're talking about sending Iskander missiles to as a counterbalance to the NATO Mishas shield and to Israel and Turkey. The Russians want to send this in, and they're having long talks with the Syrians about it. So the Russians are Syria's ally, and Syria actually was one of the first countries to support Russia when it went to war with Georgia over South Ossetia. Syria recognizes South Ossetia and Abkhazia as independent states. It's one of the only few countries. The others are Nicaragua, Venezuela, and one specific island aside from Russia. These are the countries that recognize this. So Syria was one of the first countries, and Bashar al-Assad went to Moscow to show his support. And he said Syria recognizes these countries alongside the Russian Federation.
So he's paid his dues.
He's paid it. They're allies. They're allies. The Russians will not accept.
So this is no pushover, and the Russians are from your account, unlikely to be bluffed away from this.
No, the Russians won't, and the Chinese have made it. They've been very diplomatic about it, but they will not accept a war with Iran. This is the big thing that we like. It's loosely mentioned. The Iranians and the Syrians have a military mutual defense pact, okay? They have a defense pact as well as being strategic allies. The Iranians have said they will intervene if Syria is attacked to defend their ally. So this is this is a very big – yes, it's a very big issue because if the Iranians intervene, the Russians and Chinese, not only for the sake of Syria, more importantly for the sake of Iran, will intervene. They can't afford for Iran to fall or to collapse or to change orbit. You know, Iran's independent. It's an independent ally of Moscow and Beijing, and a little too independent sometimes for them. That's why they've supported sanctions, because they supported those original UN sanctions, because those sanctions pushed away Iran from the West, the EU, and the United States, and closer to an embrace with Moscow and Beijing. Its ties politically, economically, were more intertwined with these countries in Eurasia. This is why they supported sanctions, to bring an independent ally closer to them. So it's less of a wild card. But if the Iranians go to war over Syria, they're going to be forced to intervene. In fact, the Chinese major general who's in charge of the defense college in China has said, we will not accept a war with Iran. We will intervene. The Chinese have been saying, we don't like what's happening in Pakistan and Iran. Iran is strategically tied to the Chinese. They will not accept it at all. And if you want to see a World War III scenario, it's in the making. If they go to Syria. And in fact, You know, a few years ago when I mentioned it about these possibilities and these alliances, people would, you know, they were being pessimistic about it. But now on the mainstream media, you're starting to see some talk about World War III. More analysts are talking about the possibility of a World War III global war if Syria and Iran are attacked. If Syria is attacked, Iran will intervene, and this is the biggest problem. If Iran intervenes, you're going to see Afghanistan sucked into this. You'll see the Persian Gulf.
Iraq.
Iraq. You'll see Iraq. All the American soldiers in Iraq, like an Iranian defense minister said in 2003, all the U.S. troops in Afghanistan or in Iraq, as well as the Persian Gulf, essentially, are Iranian hostages. The moment there's a war, you can say goodbye to them.
Like the Korea situation.
Like the Korea situation as well. That would be a very bloody war in the Korean Peninsula and East Asia if that happened. But the Iranians have the capability to expand way beyond their borders in fighting.
People forget what we're talking about, advanced cultures. In the case of the Islamic Republic, it's after all very old and big. It's a large state with a high degree of scientific development in every field.
It has a highly educated population, one of the countries with the most universities per capita. It has a lot of technological capability. It sends its own rockets and satellites into
space.
It has its own car manufacturing and computer manufacturing.
It's not a pushover, is it?
It was not. It arrested British troops, you know, when there was threats of war. It's not going to push over for these threats of war. And in fact, what's happening right now, how there's being pressures being applied to Iran, you can look at this pressure on Iran as a way of trying to force or negotiate with the Iranians to let go of Syria. Because this, when it comes down to it, what's going to happen very soon is the U.S. is going to have a so-called pullout from Iraq. It's a so-called pullout because it won't be complete, because they're going to still have bases in there. But they have to take most of their soldiers out of Iraq. They're afraid that when they do that, that Iranian influence will be exerted far higher than it already is in Iraq. They're afraid that Iraq would become an Iranian puppet, proxy, or it'll totally go into the Iranian camp in the Middle East. Once that happens, what happens? Iraq creates a land bridge between Iran and Syria and Lebanon on the west.
And Palestine, their favorite subject.
The Palestinians, too. The Palestinians are involved, too. But when this land bridge is created, what happens? That means if there's ever a war in the future, it changes the strategic balance in the region, first of all. Mm-hmm. If it happens, number one, it entrenches the Iranians in their resistance bloc, which is, the resistance bloc is these resistance groups and Syria and Iran put together. But what will happen is the Iranians will be able to send troops without any problem into Syria. Like, say, theoretically, there's a war for the Golan Heights or another war in Lebanon. The Iranians, just their troops cross over from Iraq, they join the war. And let me tell you, for all that we hear about Israel, it's not militarily it's not the military powerhouse that everybody says. It always picks fights with weaker countries. That's the way Israel works. You know those stories about how it defeated all those Arab armies? Well, historically, if you want to see the real historicity of the situation, they were very well armed from the beginning, okay? And those Arab armies were already weak. So
they certainly always had strategic weapon superiority. I mean, that is, the weapons in their possession were superior to their opponent.
Yes, from the very beginning, even when the Zionist groups, before they created Israel, they had weapons being shipped in for a long time. There's a lot of myths here. But anyways, what would happen now with the Iranians involved is that equation changes. If they can send their forces directly into Syria or to help Lebanon. Israel will not be able to threaten Lebanon and Syria the way it does now.
Yeah.
The whole equation is going to change. And this is what they're very worried about. So
they should be.
When they lose Iraq, they basically want to do an exchange. Okay, we might lose Iraq to the Iranians, but let's take Syria away from them. Okay? Yeah. So we even the odds, you know. And if they do that, Syria is the linchpin in this resistance bloc. If you take out Syria, then you disconnect Iran from the Palestinians, such as Hamas and the Palestinian Popular Front, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, General Command, for example, which is based in Damascus. A lot of groups. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad is another one. There's a lot of groups, secular, non-secular, Marxist, but you're going to delink them from them, and you're going to delink them from Lebanon. Iran will be delinked from Lebanon, and it'll change the equation, and that's what they want to do. This is what this is all really about.
Well, you know, Mahdi, this has been very informative, and by the way, you really have laid out the strategic picture, and as I understand it, your reading would be they're unlikely to get away with this against Syria. Am I right?
I do not, personally, I do not think they're going to launch a war. I really think what they're going to try to do is launch a civil war, okay? A regime change, a color
revolution.
A color revolution, regime change. These are what they're going to try to do. They might try to pull that buffer zone in northern Syria run by the Turks. And by the way, the Turks have made an agreement with NATO. The NATO bases in Turkey are being restructured to have ground troops now. You know, there's ground troops from Europe are being sent there.
Yeah.
But this buffer zone might be their gamble. They might gamble. You know, the United States is gambling, but the Iranians play, and some people say they invented chess. You know, it's a very different game. But I think civil war is what they're going to go for, regime change. They will not, I do not see NATO intervening into this country at all. Yeah. You know, unless they can threaten the Iranians, the Chinese, and the Russians with something. And they are putting pressure on them. But I don't see that. Otherwise, we'll see a general war, or at the very minimum, a regional war. They will escalate from the borders of China and Tajikistan and Afghanistan all the way to the eastern Mediterranean and the borders of Egypt.
Well, as somebody once said, they make trouble, fail, come back, make trouble, fail. Mahdi, it's great talking to you. And we're looking forward to all your articles, and I'd be delighted if you went to Syria. I'd love to have you over there so we could talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
Okay. Mahdi Nazimroya, globalresearch.ca. We're going to wind up. We're going to have a brief conversation, we expect, with Imam Mugara. Pardon me. And Phil is sitting here. How you doing, Phil?
Hi, Phil.
And so we'll be talking, we hope, shortly with... I get my notes here in front of me, Imam Mugara, and he's at RwandaHumanRights.org, very knowledgeable guy. We're going to do a little news reporting here. We're going to ask him about who this man is who's been assassinated, and we thought it was going to be relatively short, so it seems to fit the pattern. Hey, by the way, we had Glenn Ford in town from Black Agenda. Wasn't that great?
That was a fantastic meeting. It was a really wonderful to
see. A full house.
It was a full house.
University
of
Toronto.
So many disparate forces in the African-Canadian community, and to see how many really
very bright,
thoughtful,
authentic
that's right, really committed left-wing people that there are in that community, and with different viewpoints, but...
Not one of them has sold out.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think we're joined by Imam Mugara. Are you there, Imam?
Hi, Phil. Yes, I'm here.
I owe you an apology, Imam. I thought we were going to get to you 20 minutes earlier, but through my disorganization, ran late. You have lost a fellow journalist, Charles Ingabire, and he was assassinated in Uganda. Can you tell us, is it true, would you characterize it as assassination, and who was he?
Sure, Phil. Yes, absolutely. I have no doubt that what happened to Mr. Charles Ingabire in Kampala on the 30th of November was an assassination. He was shot by this unidentified man, but it was not a robbery in any way, shape, or form. He was really targeted, and in fact, as you may find from the announcement that was made by the newspaper that he was working for, Inyanyeri News, it was not a surprise to them. A couple of months ago, he was physically attacked and threatened by elements of the Rwandan regime who beat him, and he sustained some serious injuries and was hospitalized for 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, these attempts to silence him were not enough. So on November 30th, they had to go to the extreme end of taking away his life.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is Imad Mughara. He has an excellent site, RwandaHumanRights.org. And Imad, this man was described as an insider, somebody who had once been worked as a journalist in support of the present government in Kigali. And so he knew an awful lot, and I understand that his type of writing was somewhat anecdotal and, you know, like information of who was getting what jobs and who had power and that sort of thing within the RPF group. Is that right?
Yes, Mr. Charles Ingabire, he used to be a journalist in Rwanda. He basically grew up in exile, and then when the current government went into power, when the RPF went into power in 1994, he went back into the country thinking that it was going to be a democratic place. So he started working there as a journalist. And he was working for a paper called the Umucho in Rwanda. But as he kept on writing, like trying to be a true journalist and uncovering corruption, uncovering any government wrongdoing, his life was threatened. And so in 2007, he ran out of the country and fled to Uganda.
Mm-hmm.
So while in Uganda, he continued to write on the internet. He started off with one paper called Umuvugizi, and then in 2010, at the end of 2010, he branched off with a few of his colleagues, and they started a new online-based Rwandan newspaper called Inyenyeri News. So on that, since he had made so many acquaintances within the RPF regime, so he was able to uncover some of the information that people without his kind of links within the government would have. So he was able to come up with some whistleblower kind of information that people who don't really have those inside contacts would not have had.
Yeah. Do you know... have they? Of course, they always issue denial. The government of Kigali, Rwanda. Had they commented on him previous? Had there been? Are you aware of? Had they taking any positions publicly on the journal or on Charles Ingabire?
In terms of him personally, I'm not aware of any public comments they had made prior to this. So his any kind of comment from the regime tended to be him being threatened both physically, verbally, threatening voice messages, that kind of stuff. But in terms of an official from the Rwandan government threatening him before this, it had not happened. The only thing was back when he was a journalist in Rwanda, as they were trying to get to silence him, they would start inventing all kinds of charges against him so they can put him away in jail.
Uh-huh.
And so that led to him fleeing the country, as every other week they would come up with some new charge to try and put him in jail.
Yeah. By the way, do you know the time frame? How long ago did he leave the country? Would you know?
Yeah, that was 2007. It has been 4 years.
That he had to flee.
Yes.
This is Imam Mughara, and he has a wonderful site, RwandaHumanRights.org. I urge you, everybody, to go there for background on Rwanda. But could you explain the situation of the government of Uganda and Rwanda? We see the photographs occasionally of President Museveni standing beside President Kagame, and they're smiling. But then people get assassinated, and they come to blows once in a while, those two governments. What is the government of Uganda saying or doing, for example, about this intimidation and killing of Rwandan nationals inside Uganda?
So you're right. In terms of Rwanda and Uganda, they have a very interesting history. One of them being that at the beginning, General Kagame of Rwanda, he was in the rebellion fighting to put Museveni in power in Uganda. And then once Museveni was in power, he appointed Kagame to various positions of responsibility within Uganda. So just before Kagame attacked Rwanda, he was the chief of military intelligence in Uganda.
Very important.
So there seems to be this friendship earlier on, but then eventually when the two armies of, after Kagame became president of Rwanda, and then both the armies of Rwanda and Uganda, they invaded Congo at the same time, and under the pretext of chasing armed militias. But in the end, it turned out that they were more interested in plundering Congo's resources.
Right.
So there was a situation in the late 1990s where the two armies of Rwanda and Uganda clashed in the mines of the Congo. These were like in the area that's rich in diamonds.
They fought each other in the Congo.
They fought each other in the Congo. And they lost a big number of soldiers on each side. If I remember correctly, there have been over 1,000 on each side were lost fighting for minerals in Congo between the two armies. So from that moment on, it seems to be that the friendship between Kagame and Museveni was not there as much anymore, because you had this guy that Museveni had mentored, and now Kagame feels that he's stronger than Museveni and is able to have his troops fight Museveni's troops.
Mm-hmm.
So from then on, they're not very friendly to each other, every now and then the powers that are interested in the two of them getting along try to bring them together. In fact, right now, next week, Kagame, the president of Rwanda, Kagame, is scheduled to be in Uganda. So a lot of Rwandan people believe that the killing of this journalist may have something to do with an advanced group of Kagame's people who are going to prepare for his security in Uganda. That some of those people may have been the ones involved in the killing of this journalist.
Their idea of advanced work is to assassinate anybody who might ask a question.
Unfortunately, it appears to be so.
Well, will the Ugandan... the Ugandan media is pretty lively, right? I understand they have been saying a few things. Would ordinarily the Ugandans say they suspect someone? Or I know they've taken somebody into custody. Or is it likely to ever make a link with Kagame in this situation?
You know, that's going to be interesting to watch, because last year in South Africa, where a dissident general from Kagame's army, when they tried to assassinate him during the Soccer World Cup, the people who were arrested had close links to the Rwandan government, and the South African government did not seem to hide that. They expelled the Rwandan ambassador to South Africa. But in the case of Rwanda and Uganda, I think the two men, Museveni and Kagame, I think they have too much dirt on each other. So I doubt that Museveni would allow.
And they sort of work for the same. They have the same big friends, right? Britain and the United States, who give them advice.
Absolutely. They both have the same masters who tell them what to do. So I doubt that they would publicly accuse each other of that killing.
Ah. Well, this is, we've been speaking to Aimab Mugara. Thank you very much. It's very informative, and we're going to keep following it. We're kind of tired of journalists being assassinated. So we're not going to let this go by. So I hope we can talk to you in the future about Charles Ingabire.
Thank you, Phil. Indeed, thank you for bringing to light this tragedy that Mr. Charles Ingabire went through.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Aimab Mugara. And we spoke earlier to Mahdi Nazim Roya. And Phil and I were delighted to see Glenn Ford Black Agenda Report. And so for the Taylor Report, for Alex and Phil, this is Phil Taylor saying check us, taylor-report.com, and we'll see you next week.